the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life. Healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. And first this morning, Jay Burke and I speak with local mountain biker and Olympic silver medalist from the Paris Olympics, Haley Batten. Haley joins the show to talk about the race in which she won her silver medal, about growing up in Park City, and about why she continues to love and be an ambassador for the sport. Then Mary Beth Maziarz and I have a conversation with naturopathic physician Dr. Nicole Kane. Nicole is a pioneer in integrative approaches for mental and emotional wellness and takes a holistic approach to ridding ourselves of anxiety. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Jay Burke.
Our next guest is Olympic silver medalist, Park City's Haley Batten. Haley earned Team USA's best ever mountain biking finish in the Paris Olympics, and she's hot off the UCI World Cup tour and joins us now for the next conversation in our series of these people who really make our mountain town. We're excited to talk to her. Haley Batten, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Hi, Lynn. Jay, so great to be on here with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we're so glad that you could join us. It would have been relatively impossible to track you down over the last 3 or 4 months. I was just rewatching the highlights from your race in Paris. It was just so amazing to see you come across the finish line. And there was this twinge of almost disbelief or, oh my gosh, this is really happening that I saw. Can you describe that moment?
Oh gosh, yeah. Those moments where everything really comes together, where your mind and your body and your bike are just like in that flow state, you know, and everything clicks. And it's really, really rare that you can have a race like that. And so that's why those moments are so special. But you really train for years for those, like that one couple seconds, you know, at the finish line. And I think, you know, I've had a lot of, you know, ups and downs in sport in general. That's just what life is as an athlete. But I think that race also showcased just what mountain biking is all about. You know, I had a flat tire and there, it was just nobody knew who would end up on that podium. So I think there was a lot of disbelief, you know, excitement, relief, and just satisfaction for all the hard work that I put in. So yeah, it was a really magical experience for me in Paris. And I'm really happy I could share that with a lot of amazing friends and family, and then bringing it home to my communities as well.
Well, a huge congratulations. It was really so exciting for all the folks here at home. And, you know, watching that race, that's what it really sticks in everyone's head. And when I was watching it, just looking at some of the spills taken, that rock garden, I mean, most of us don't get to see what these courses look like, but that rock garden was quite something, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, I mean, our World Cup courses are definitely quite technical. And I think, you know, you go and watch Rampage in Utah and you're like, oh, wow, like mountain biking's so hardcore. And cross country isn't that. But I think sometimes it's underestimated the type of terrain that we're riding and also the mental fatigue, you know, when you're physically, you know, pushing your limits and then have to ride these technical features. So there's a lot of focus and preparation where you have to be able to train that ability to race, you know, with your highest heart rate and then ride these technical features. And that course was so fun because just the high speed, the race dynamics, it allowed for group racing and really exciting tactics as well as these technical features. So I really think that you had to have the whole package of a mountain bike racer, those are my favorite courses when you have to be technically skilled, physically fit, but also a smart racer and to be able to ride in those groups and think, you know, on your toes during the race. So yeah, I loved that course. And also just the way it brought in the fans and the spectators and created this amazing ambiance for everybody there was really cool. You could just really see a lot of the parts of the course as a spectator and viewer, and then really as a racer, hear the crowds and feel that energy, which definitely fuels me a lot. So I loved the whole, yeah, everything that they did in Paris and how they built that course was really cool.
It's so great to have you on. And to that point, it's just so cool to see how the cross country has changed mm-hmm. over the last decade to be, like you're saying, more spectator friendly, especially, well, I would say both from a, you know, broadcast perspective and an in-person perspective. Yeah. It's got to be so rewarding for you all as racers. It's almost like cyclocross. It's kind mm-hmm. of turned into, you know, those shorter courses where you can really have touch points out there. So that's so fun.
No, you're right. And I mean, I think even the World Cup's bringing those short track races too, where now we have that 20-minute event where, you know, the people watching the races can get really excited, you know, watch that Friday yeah. evening or Saturday morning, however it lines up with the time zones, and get kind of excited and curious about then what's going to happen on the XCO race, which is just an hour and a half. And once you're tied to those racers and you get, you know, great shots of those features, you want to know what's happening. So I think they are doing a good job, and it's great progress for our sport. And I think, I mean, I was just at the NICA State Championships in Cedar City last weekend, and just seeing the numbers of kids coming out of Utah and all over, you know, even when I was in Arkansas too, like we were just talking about, there's just so many kids getting this sport. And I think when you can see the highest level of racing and it's exciting to watch and it's cool to be part of, I think it definitely draws those kids. And I think because cycling is just such a great sport for communities and for people in general, for commuting and just all the positives that it has, I think when kids are drawn to this sport, and maybe for performance, but I think just for life and for communities in general, I think that can be a really good thing. So I'm excited to see how our sport's growing and what comes next for sure.
Well, you're a poster child for it. I mean, honestly, you know, I've been fortunate to know you a long time and watch you grow up on a bike. I think a lot of us that were around you saw the vision early. You know, I mean, you were just so committed to the bike. It was just it was so much fun. Let's talk a little bit about you growing up in Park City. I mean, you weren't born in Utah, but what year did you all get to Utah, your family? Yeah.
I know I started first grade there. So first grade all the way through Park City High. So as long as I can really remember and be doing cool stuff, you know.
I don't remember you not ever being on a bike. And we've been around you since I think we met you right when you all moved to town.
We were probably at a bike race when our families met.
Yeah, probably. We're somewhere. I just have visions of you all the kids playing in the, you know, in the dirt at 24 hours of Moab. And when did you really start to have aspirations? You know, it had to have been fairly early there, maybe in those NICA years when you were racing and, you know, that you felt like, I'm going to embrace this and go for it.
Yeah, no, it's so great having this conversation with you, Jay, because I feel like you were a big part of that with the midweek series, you know, all the racing you and my family, like our parents were doing. And then just my earliest memories too were just all of our families and all the kids riding together. And I think just a lot of people in the generations before didn't have that, where, you know, you're around all your peers doing this fun sport. And then you go into NICA and all your peers again in high school. And so I think that was a huge part for me. I mean, those NICA, I mean, the midweek races you were running and then the Intermountain Cup races, there were so many kids and my friends racing. And that was huge for me early on. And challenged me a lot. I mean, yeah, sure, there was a ton of guys racing, but they really like put me under their wing and I was hanging out with them and we were all friends, which was awesome. But I think going back to your question, where it really all started was probably when my family first started traveling a little bit, you know, domestically to other states to race. You know, maybe we popped into Colorado Colorado for the small races, or Idaho, and then, you know, maybe the Sea Otter Classic in California. And then when we raced, maybe my second, I think we did two national championships in Sun Valley, Idaho, again, with our whole Utah squad, like all the kids from Utah. We had like a big house together, I remember, and everybody was racing. And it was like the first time we're going to a larger stage for races. So I remember in 2012 in Sun Valley, I'd won my first like junior national title there. And that was the same year as the London Olympics. So they brought up like everybody that had qualified. So Georgia Gould, Leah Davison, Sam Schultz, and Todd Wells. They're like, this is your Olympic team for mountain biking. And I think then I was like, whoa. Like one, I just started following like the elite riders and, you know, had just gotten all their signatures on our hats and started to see that there's this professional world. And now we're stepping outside of Utah. We're racing at a higher level. There's all these girls that I'm now competing with, when before, you know, in Utah, I'm just competing with guys. So I see this other level of racing with other girls and really strong, fast girls too. So I'm starting to be really challenged in other ways. And then you know, I think as a kid, I always watched the Olympics. It was like, oh, the
Yeah.
Olympics. So it was always, you know, a childhood dream. So then to connect the dots between the sport that I'm starting to fall in love with, and, you know, I'm probably high on myself with this little national champ jersey too. But I think literally I was probably like 14 years old and I was like, okay, I think I want to go to the Olympics for mountain biking.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Great. If you're just joining us on the Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Olympic silver medalist Haley Batten. She grew up in Park City. Haley, we're so glad that we could pin you down for today. You know, as you're talking, it seems to me that you, let's see, are you about 25 right now?
I'm
26?
26. Yeah. Yeah.
26. For those of our listeners who don't know what NYCA is, you were in this time that it really exploded. Can you explain what that explosion was and what NYCA? I actually don't even know what it stands for, but I know what it is.
Yeah, I think it stands for National Interscholastic Cycling Association.
Okay, yeah.
And it's basically a state high school cycling program. So bringing, you know, cycling, which I think for a long time was a sport where you got on these teams and you were supported and sponsored by brands. And I think it really brought that into the school system to make it a school sport and, you know, spreading that into high schools across the country. And it really started, I think, in California and then has really just taken off. And honestly, the cool part is Utah has just exploded. So I think Utah is by far the biggest league now and is split into six regions and has about 7,500 kids that race. And so when you show up to, you know, these races, it's not just the kids that are there racing, but it's their families, their friends. I joke with the riders that it's like the energy is like a World Cup because there's just so many people that are so excited and the energy is just so fun because you're bringing this school sport atmosphere into mountain bike racing, which I think is so fun. I think the first year that it started in Utah was the year before I started high school, and my mom was somewhat involved in helping get that team kickstarted and for Utah and for the Park City team. So that was cool. And then the second year of the league, I was a freshman and I actually raced in the varsity category. It was a blast to, I think, race with all my peers again because I'd been already traveling to Europe, traveling across the country to race. And I think it really brought it slowed down the sport for me and gave me a lot of perspective because I think I was getting a little carried away at that time with just my big goals and racing and taking it very seriously. And I think being able to ride with, you know, the kids that I go to high school with and slow down and appreciate the community aspect of it was really important for me at the time.
Absolutely. You no doubt made a celebrity appearance in Southern Utah at the recent NYCA championships. I'm suspecting that's what it was. And you mentioned like how great it is that so many kids are getting into mountain biking. I think there are a lot of parents who are concerned now with the popularity of the e-bikes, and you see so many kids in Park City just cruising around electric motorcycles because that's essentially what they are. It seems the class three. Do you see anything like that, like kids moving away from actually pedaling a bike that doesn't have motor assist?
Yeah, no, I feel like that's a great question. I think it depends on what your perspective is, right? If you're riding mountain bikes and that's you're spending your time often, you know, doing, you know, pedaling on your own, it's, you know, physical, it's hard work, you're getting your heart rate pumping, you know. If you're coming from that angle, yeah, okay, maybe it's not as good that, you know, all these kids are pushing to getting to mountain bike or to e-bikes. But I think if you come from the other perspective of all these kids driving to school in their cars, I think it's just you have to start weighing, pick and choosing your battles for sure. Because I think if you can take these awesome e-bikes to from, you know, we see it all the time in Santa Cruz as well. Like these kids are ripping around Santa Cruz, you know, to go to school, to go, they have their surfboards on the side. And I think that's awesome because we have a lot of right now is this disconnection from, you know, social media, you know, just lack of time outside in general, you know, wind in your hair, connection to the outdoors, you know, seeing, you know, where new buildings are going up and being like, oh, I loved how that bike path was just in this, you know, forest. And now it's not anymore. So you just become more aware of your environments, your communities, you're connecting with you know, your neighbors because you're outside, right? And I think often the car creates a very stressful environment, you know, environmentally a lot of. So I think if that's the angle you come from, I think it's a big positive. I mean, from my side as well, like now both of my parents have e-bikes and I have one as well, and they can now ride with me on my super hard, you know, big epic rides. And my dad is like who I grew up riding in the woods with, you know, as a kid in high school, right after work and after school, we'd go out, you know, with our lights on until it was dark. And that was like what we shared. And now, you know, a couple times we like go out before he goes to work and we can take our e-bikes and get in two laps. And then he hops in his car and drives and commutes to work. And, you know, the sun is rising and then I go back and start my day, you know? So that's really fun to share. And I think there's a place for it. And I think these communities really need to figure out how we can balance it on these, you know, in Park City where you have these two-way trail systems that are high speed. Yeah, if you have an e-bike, you're coming up and someone going down really fast, that's dangerous, right? So I think there's a way where we can create an environment where e-bikes have a place to get people kickstarted into cycling or help them continue into their age with cycling. But I think there's a balance of creating a safe infrastructure for sure. And as it gets more popular, I think that, you know, just like any city needs to design their roads properly for you know, higher populations, it needs to happen on the trails too.
Love the idea of getting people on bikes. And it just reminds me of traveling with your family. I mean, that going to Europe and even before the e-bike thing became popular, just, you know, going to these different countries where bikes are a way of life, you know, and the kids are riding to school on bikes and, you know, rather than being in a car chatting, they're just riding down the street talking to one another, and love to see more of that. So that's a great point that you make there. So I want you to think outside of the box a little bit, but like growing up on the Wasatch back, what was your favorite part about that? I don't want to have to say it, but besides the trails.
Yeah. Besides the trails. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are so many special things about our community, but I mean, it'll be hard to get away from the trails. Cause for me, like the access when I was in high school as like a young woman to just be able to go ride that start, you know, it started with my dad. We were riding together all the time, just like out, you know, you have these amazing views from the Crest Trail, you just, or the aspen trees in the fall, and you're just in love with being out there. And then that really turned into me, you know, having the independence to go ride alone for hours. Like I was just out in the mountains alone forever. And I just loved it. And it gave me so much independence, confidence, empowerment. And I think that started to apply to all aspects of my life, you know, in school too. But I think beyond just the trails, I think the whole energy that brings to our community, you know, the way, you know, Main Street just is so beautiful, like in those mountains. And, you know, I think the Olympic atmosphere that we also have, and these Olympic facilities for athletes as well. I mean, yeah, that's all athlete stuff, but I think it also, you know, just be able to walk on the bike paths, you know, surrounded by, you know, with swan or nature. There's just so the community is built in such an amazing way where you're so close to the outdoors. And I think the whole community celebrates it and appreciates each other that, you know, everybody that wants to get out and in it. Yeah. So that's really
cool. Yeah, truly. We have, you know, so many people moving to town.
Yeah.
You know, oftentimes it's like if you just stop and take a look at what we have through their eyes, and I'm like, wow, this place is pretty killer.
Yeah.
I live here. This is cool.
Yeah. And it's cool for me too, because I like grew up there and then have left for a long time. And then just going back this past weekend, like I'm looking to move back. So it's nice to have that other perspective of like everybody's like, oh, it's changed so much, you know.
Yeah,
and then
it has.
But also, you know, seeing that it still has that character that it always had, you know, with the artwork and these sculptures and just the little things that really makes it such a great town. And I think what's so important is just, I remember growing up just how great, you know, especially going to California, you know, just how everybody that used the trails in different ways respected each other, right? If that was with dogs, hikers, bikers, there was this community still and friendship, and you always said hello on the trail. You know, you always pulled over to let people go by. And I think as the masses, you know, come and other people move from out of town, it's like, those are the best things. Like I remember riding in other places and like pulling over, you know, when you're going downhill and like saying hi and have a great ride. And then the next person, and then next time I'm going up, someone just rips down, you know, and they just knock you off the trail. And I had to learn, you know, that way of riding trails, because I just wasn't used to it at all.
Well, some of our users are still learning too here. So
yeah, I'm sure.
And it takes a little bit, but we'll give them a minute.
Yep. Yeah. No, it's important. It's so important, especially with the number of trails and the amount of people using them now. I mean, I'm sure that's only growing, is that that aspect is just super crucial to hang on to. And I think it's special we have that in Park City.
Oh yeah. And the trail, like I mean, I totally get it. Like the trails are your number one for sure. And it's funny, Hillary and I, my wife, were out riding the other day and we were down in that new zone over by Spin Cycle that they've worked in a bunch of new trails over there. And Hillary just looked at me and she's like, "How could you ever leave this? You know, like I mean, we wait long enough and you can go out for a ride next week and ride some trail that you've never ridden before." It's just like that's the volume of trails we have here, and that's a really cool thing. So, okay, so aside from mom and dad, and I want to shout out to them, Pat and Kathy Batten, doing such a fine job of raising you. Like in the community, who would you shine a light on as being someone that really guided you along in your journey?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I definitely had amazing teachers like growing up as well, like through school in elementary school and in high school. And you know, I remember, you know, like you said, my family, we would go on all sorts of adventures. So I think in fifth grade or something, they took us out of school for I think what was going to be a couple of weeks and turned into like that Icelandic volcano that stopped
Remember
all
that.
flights, you know, and we were maybe gone for a couple of months. Who knows? I don't remember. But you know, having these adaptable teachers that you know appreciated what we were doing and assigned, you know, different projects where we could appreciate what we were doing in this exploring and bring that back to the education. And then also, I mean, into high school, allowing me to travel and do the sport that I loved and compete, but still get through school in an effective way because I always loved learning. So I think I had great teachers and that also inspired me to, you know, continue to go to school, you know, through racing as well. I also did a lot of Nordic ski racing. So Steve Cook on the Park City High School
Yeah,
team and
Steve
then,
Cook, great guy.
yeah, Park City, sorry, ski team and then Tuna, the Utah Nordic Alliance with those
Yeah.
tuna fish up the lake.
Oh
So
my gosh,
yeah,
yeah.
he's such a legend. And I think I remember one of the coaches said one time, "Oh yeah, you have to ask Steve about his Paralympic medals." And I was like, "Paralympic medals? You mean Olympic medals?" You know, because I just had no idea that he
Yeah,
was a
right.
Paralympian. And I think from then on, I was even more inspired by like what he had accomplished. And he was just so supportive of me and we're still in touch. So I think I had a lot
That
of
is
people
awesome.
like that. And then even going back farther to young riders, you know,
Yeah.
and I mean, you and Midweek, and then when it was passed over to Brooke and everybody. So I just so many super
Yeah.
cool people in our community. The list goes on and on and on.
It's hard. It's just hard not to recognize the amount of support that is in this community for athletes like yourself. And I mean, you look at Keegan and you look at many other sports. I mean, they're just, you know, we have such a great community
And
here.
also, like when you got me and my dad on White Pine touring, like that was awesome.
Oh
Like
my gosh,
those
yeah.
Thursday, was it Thursday night rides or Tuesday night rides?
In ours, yeah. Thursday night rides, yeah.
Yeah, that was awesome. That was a game changer for me, actually. I don't think I ever knew because I was doing intervals. Like super hard intervals without knowing it, because I was just riding hard with you guys. But the
Yeah.
support I think that the community provided me, you know, early on was just, you know, feeling a little bit of that belief and support, and just the cycling community was just that it kickstarted everything for me for sure. And you're right, there's just so many great people in that area.
Well, along those lines, Haley, it's making me think, you know, occasionally I will see you out biking and I don't really know it's you until I get up close. I suspect it is you because I'll be coming down the mine road and you'll just be cranking up. The same with Keegan Swenson. I'll see him out there. And there's this sense of pride that we have in our community for people like you and people like Keegan Swenson and the other athletes like Jay talks about. Like we to some degree feel like you belong to us. And I'm just wondering from your perspective, you know, does that feel like a pressure or do you feel it when you're around town in the grocery store or anything like that? What does it feel like?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just special because I think you know, the best part about some people keep asking me, oh, do you want to keep, like, do you want, are you okay if I ask you about the Olympics or are you sick of it? I'm like, no, that was, you know, that was the best thing. Of course I want to keep talking about it. But the best part about it is that all these people and communities that were involved, because it's so, people don't understand that it's so much more than just the athlete. It is this team and village of people that help you get there. And literally all of it is impossible unless you have, I mean, I could go on and on. I have a coach, a strength coach, a nutritionist, my family, you know, this big team. I have these communities I grew up with, you know, that helped me do this. And so to be able to bring that medal back home and to these communities and share it with them and be like, thank you, you know, that's the best part. So for me, no, it's not pressure at all. It's that we all want to try and do this cool thing. You know, right now we don't have it, so nothing changes, right? But we might as well try. And if we can, then it's awesome, you know, and we get to share it with all these people and places that made it possible. So, no, I love that. And I think when it comes to like the attention and talking about myself all the time, that I'm not as good at, because I don't race bikes for the followers on Instagram or the people recognizing me in the grocery store, you know. I do it because I love racing my bike and I love the feeling of high performance and I love the flow and I love being outdoors and I love doing that with the people I love. So if anything, if this gets some more kids on bikes and communities, you know, building bike paths, I think that would make me super happy. And that's the least, yeah, I can do.
I have to interject there. I mean, just because, you know, I think listeners might think, oh, you know, Haley's just saying that, but it's true. Like, I never have met anyone that wanted to be on their bike more than Haley did. And I've known her for a long time. And it's just so special to see this come back to you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jay.
Yeah. That's great. Well, before we let you go, we know that you've been doing this UCI World Cup series all season. So you've been busy. It's not like you just go win a silver medal at the Paris Olympics and then, you know, then you're kind of done. So give us an overview of what that is. I actually find it kind of hard to find all the races and how they all go online.
There's a lot of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, so actually 3 weeks after the Olympics, we had the World Championships in Andorra. So I was really lucky. My family, just as they are, we went for a week in Portugal and I didn't even take my bike out of the bike bag. And we just enjoyed some slow time and surfing and just hanging out together, which was really special. And then from there, I had like a couple weeks to prepare for Worlds. And I think it was definitely, you know, a bit of a different challenge to, you know, be able to pivot and focus again on more big goals. But at the end of the day, I think I was just so, I felt so good at the Olympics, and that peak experience of form that you have when you're at your best is addictive in a way. It's such a good feeling to be able to climb up hills like that. So I was eager to have another good race, but I think, you know, it's a long season. The human body's only capable of so much. And I think I tried to ask myself for a lot, but I have to look back at the goals I set, and that was qualify for the Olympics and go to the Olympics. And that's, you know, and medal at the Olympics. And that's exactly what I did. So I think when it came to all the races, you know, we had World Championships in Andorra for cross country. And then I went to World Championships for marathon and in snowshoe. So that was like about a 5 hour race. And there I ended up, unfortunately, crashing and hitting my head and getting a minor concussion. So that delayed, or that actually took me out of the rest of the season. So I went to Lake Placid for another World's Cup in the US. And then we had a World Cup in Quebec, Canada. So I was really, really excited for that last part of the season. That was all in North America, just because it's not often as cross-country races that we get to race in North America. A lot of it is in Europe. So I was a bit bummed about that, but I think I'm learning a lot, you know, and the sport always humbles you. You know, every time you're on cloud nine, it somehow gets you back in the dirt and wiping yourself off. So I'm learning from all of those challenges for sure. And I'm definitely motivated for the years ahead.
Well, it is so fun to hear you talk about everything that you have, from community to competition to growing up in Park City and all of your experiences. Thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life. It's Haley Batten, Park City's own.
No, it's great having you, Haley. Yeah. And we hope that you land back in the community.
Lynn and Jay, thank you so much. Park City's the best, and it's fun to go back and relive all this. So thank you for having me.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Our guest is naturopathic physician, Dr. Nicole Kane. Nicole is a pioneer on integrative approaches for mental and emotional wellness. Her approach to mental health is multidisciplinary, medical, psychological, and holistic. She joins us today to talk about a holistic approach to ridding ourselves of anxiety. She will take us through the 9 types of anxiety and share her bottom-up repatterning, an approach to mental health that focuses on regulating the body to heal the mind due to their profound interconnectedness. She's written a new book about it called Panic Proof. Dr. Nicole Kane, welcome to The Mountain Life.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with this idea that there are multiple types of anxiety. Who knew? I think we imagine anxiety is just that kind of bubbling nervousness that many of us get in certain situations. Tell us a little bit about how you've discovered that this is separated into many different types.
Well, one of the biggest myths about anxiety is that I don't have anxiety, that we don't experience it. And so when I was working with clients over the past 15 plus years, people would come in and they would be describing these symptoms of autonomic arousal, where their body is kind of going into that fight, flight, freeze. But it was a little bit different for everyone. And I thought it would be interesting if we took a look at all the research and just explored, are there any unifying themes with these different types of presentations on anxiety? And if that's the case, does it add value to the anxiety freedom conversation? And it turns out that it does.
Wonderful. So what would be the first way that somebody who suspects they're feeling certain kinds of anxiety could start to discover where in that matrix they might fall?
The first thing is to be aware and to acknowledge our body and our mind and our emotional sensations. We live in a culture where anxiety is seen as the problem, and we really quickly jump to solutions to try to make it stop, to try to make it go away. And we see a couple of things happening with that in the literature. One is what we deny will amplify, and what we resist will persist. And so there's a gift in allowing ourselves to notice and acknowledge what we feel. So by default, just acknowledging it can be therapeutic for anxiety. And then secondarily is when we acknowledge it, we get a little bit more clarity and understanding about what the body is telling us is going on. Again, the 9 types is a really nice way to organize that information. And I'd love to explain that more.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Dr. Nicole Kane. She is a naturopathic physician, and she's written a new book called Panic Proof. We're talking about anxiety and the subtypes of anxiety. Now, Nicole, when I saw the 9 types of anxiety, I thought, well, okay, there's social anxiety. Let's see, there's... And then I stopped.
Yes.
But this is not at all what you're talking about. You're talking about types of anxiety throughout our body. So we have to get in touch with where we're feeling it in our body. Can you expand on that?
Yes. And I appreciate the nuance that you just pointed out here is the difference between a conventional diagnosis of anxiety, which we have those symptoms laid out in a book called the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. And so the DSM essentially has generalized anxiety disorder, panic disorder, and then just sort of a smattering of in between. And so the 9 types of anxiety is looking at the ways uniquely that anxiety can show up, as you said, the different systems it can present in. And I want to give an example, if I may, about how we're already doing this in clinical practice, but we might not really realize it because the conversation just hasn't been formulated. And so generally somebody has anxiety. Let's say that they have gut anxiety and they get that knowing in their stomach, that kind of butterflies in their stomach, but then it can amplify into full-fledged panic where they have terrible diarrhea or heartburn or gas and bloating. If they go to the doctor, the conventional doctor's been trained, the gas and bloating is a problem, so we'll send them to a gastroenterologist to take care of that. And then we treat the emotional symptoms. We treat the anxiety, oftentimes with maybe an antidepressant or talk therapy. And we could do a little better, and we see this. So let's say in the example of somebody with chest anxiety, their heart is pounding out of their chest, it's skipping beats. They're worried they're going to have a heart attack. They go to the doctor. The doctor knows about chest anxiety. They can give them something called propranolol, a beta blocker, which will help the heart not pound so violently when they're anxious. And so just by knowing, even with our current nomenclature, just by knowing the little bit of nuance in how it presents is already giving us information about diagnosis and treatment. And so I know we've been kind of talking about the nine types from a sky view, and those are two of them.
Yeah, that's very interesting. You say that one of the nine types is the immune system. And this is interesting because we're on the rise with all of these crazy autoimmune diseases. And of course, makes one wonder, what is the connection to anxiety? Can you go into that a little bit?
I'm really passionate about this for the exact reasons that you said, is we are seeing so much inflammation, immune system dysfunction. We're seeing some long haul symptoms that can occur after infections. And here's something that many of us might relate to. So if anybody listening to this conversation has just checked in with yourself, do you ever experience itchy eyes, runny nose, post-nasal drip, maybe sneezing? So those, we can say, oh yeah, those are my allergies. They're coming out right now. They're driving me nuts. But what you might not know is that that same chemical, histamine, that's causing these allergy symptoms could also be causing anxiety. Histamine can be as activating to your nervous system as adrenaline. And so immune system anxiety, if you want to get to the root cause of that anxiety, that person who has allergies and anxiety, if they go to the doctor and they just get an antidepressant or do talk therapy, we're missing a giant opportunity to listen to the symptoms of the body and to say, okay, why? Why do we have immune system anxiety and what can we do about it?
Right. And so in using that example, how would you address that with a client?
Yeah. So somebody comes in and they say, oh, I've had the worst allergies. I've been having insomnia. I've been having panic attacks. This is really common in my perimenopausal, postmenopausal patients. And the first question we ask is, well, one is, do you have high histamine? An allergist can confirm this. And so they come in. So you have high histamine. Why do you have high histamine? And so when we look at the brain, the body, and the nervous system, and we look at the trauma-informed research, it's coming out with amazing works like The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk, right? We look at the trauma-informed neuroscience and we know that the body has adapted to something and that adaptation is continuing to be played out today. And so number one is, why is that adaptation coming out in immune system anxiety and what do we do about it? And then number two is, how do we go and reverse engineer that? And so it's kind of a multi-prong process.
Wow, that is so interesting. So there are both long-term approaches that are systemic, as well as probably some acute treatments that you recommend for clients. In this case of somebody who was having trouble with insomnia and histamines and something like that, how might both of those different approaches arise?
Yeah, a conventional practitioner might say, try hydroxyzine. And so they would give you a prescription for hydroxyzine. And so if that helps you fall asleep, that's bringing down inflammation. And so then they may treat that. But I think we could take it a step further. And if we look at the physiology, if we look at the science of histamine, We know that histamine can come into the body from the environment. It can come in from environmental toxins. It can come in from high histamine foods like citrus. Who knew, right? And then secondarily, our body can produce histamine. We have a whole host of gut microbes that are living their best lives, producing all sorts of neurochemicals, regulating your gut-brain axis, communicating with your immune system, your hormones. So your gut might be producing histamine. And then the third reason histamine might be high is if you aren't properly detoxifying histamine. And there are three pathways that really need to be leveraged to drain histamine out so that you're not bubbling over with histamine symptoms.
Just one response to that. I used to feel a little bit of social anxiety, and I thought that it made me, my cheeks flush and things like that. But what I discovered was that often I would have a cocktail or something at the beginning of a social event, and that I am one of those people who doesn't break down acetylcholine very well in my system. And so I was getting all flushed because of my, you know, self-medicating before a social event. And so I really am responding to what you're talking about.
Yes. And isn't that life-changing and empowering? Instead of being like, well, my body is rebelling and I can't even calm down with a cocktail. Yes. Instead, you could be really mindful, which I know you are because you've discovered this, because you did deeper digging to say, okay, my body isn't as efficient at breaking down acetylcholine. How can I support that process so that if I choose to have a drink, then I won't have now layers upon layers of symptoms?
And my red face won't make me even more anxious.
Exactly. People won't be like, are you okay? And then you're like, ah, no, actually I'm not.
Well, let's pretend that we're in your office. I'm going to ask you a further question about Mary Beth's condition, which would be, would you then imagine that if she has a cocktail just when she's at home and relaxed and in a very comfortable environment, would she get the same flushed cheeks?
Ooh, this is a really good question. And I feel like we might need to do an experiment just to see. So no, your homework.
It's too early in the morning to have a cocktail.
There's something, it's called the stress diathesis model. And we think about this in the image. I like to use the metaphor of a cup with marbles on the inside. And so we all come into life and we have a cup, and that cup represents how much stress we're able to hold. And the marbles inside of the cup represent diathesis or risk factors. And so these risk factors take up space for the stress of life, which is going to represent the water pouring into the cup. So if you have lots of factors that are going in, for example, maybe you have poor liver detoxification and you have a backlog of things that your body's been trying to eradicate, but you don't have the enzymatic or the microbiota support. And so your cup is already full of marbles. And then maybe you just got a deadline that just got pushed forward and you're like, oh my gosh. And so now your body is producing cortisol. And then that cortisol is putting you into autonomic arousal and it's suppressing inflammation. And so now your immune system is being suppressed. And so then your kid came in from a new day at school, got a little bit of something and coughed on you. And so now, so right, we have these multivariables. And so now your cup is full. And so the question that you asked, Lynn, is a really good question. It's like, okay, well, then if I go out and I socialize and I have a glass of wine in this situation versus if I just went to Bali and laid on the beach and did yoga and took out as many of these marbles as possible, would the effect be the same? And I think the most high integrity answer of that is, it depends on the person. We would have to see.
Yeah.
I would say beta tests, being more relaxed and being in the right, like stress-free environment absolutely affects that for me.
That is very interesting.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, one of the types of anxiety that you mention is anger as anxiety, which I find really interesting. We recently in our very small community had a very shocking road rage incident in which an innocent person lost their life. it's unfathomable to me to think that someone could get that angry in their car. It's just left me with this big question. What happens? Why are we so angry? Or why are some people so angry?
Right. Yeah, I feel like this is such an important question to ask, because when we talk about fight, flight, freeze, and then there's also for fun, flop, fawn, and fracture, these responses of the autonomic nervous system when we go into arousal, is a lot of us are familiar with the freeze, like a deer in headlights when I get anxious, or fight flight, where I'm going to run away or escape. I'm in a social anxiety situation. Oh, my Uber's here, got to go. But the fight we don't often talk about in context of autonomic arousal. We often talk about it in context of behavior. And so one is that the chemicals that get released during autonomic arousal are fairly similar, depending on if you're running away from danger or if you're freezing in danger, as if you're fighting in danger. And so the question is what happened or didn't happen to you in your past, or what is happening or isn't happening to you in your present that has resulted in an adaptation where this is necessary and beneficial for you? And so specific examples of that may be when you were younger, maybe that's the behavior that you learned in your culture, in your family environment. Maybe that was the only safe behavior. If you exhibited other behaviors, you would be hurt or in danger or punished. And we see this when we think about the different causes of anxiety, is there's biological causes. So we talked about histamine. There's psychological causes. And so we could talk about our family environment and how we were treated and our self-esteem, but there are also societal and environmental causes. And so what's happening in our culture and in our society where people are becoming so activated that they're engaging in these egregious acts? And I think a big point about this is we have a real opportunity to teach about the stoplight strategies, is how I kind of define them, of autonomic arousal, to see if we could start helping people when they're in the beginning whispers of arousal before it turns into shouts and they have road rage and do something really dangerous and harmful.
Very interesting. Do you believe, Nicole, that we can deal with any type of anxiety without being medicated for anxiety?
Yeah. You know what? I think medications have been life-saving for so many people. In fact, Lexapro is a SSRI antidepressant, and that was life-saving for me. And so if you find that that's your story and that these antidepressants have given you your life back, then that's incredible. And I encourage people to, instead of saying, okay, well, my story is I have to take Zoloft the rest of my life, period, at the end of my sentence, I'm just going to have to manage anxiety the rest of my life, is this book and what my mission is and what I've seen time and time again across the world, I've worked with patients all around the world, is that if we put a semicolon at the end of that sentence, we can do even better. And some people, many people, make the choice to pursue anxiety freedom with medications, and many choose it without medications. And so it really depends on that unique individual and what gives them most life, most freedom. It's all about taking back your power and how that looks for you.
That's so interesting. In another part of my life, I work with musicians and speakers sometimes, and their number one issue is stage fright every time. Yeah. Everyone's so concerned about this. They have something they really want to say or want to perform, but this holds them back. And one of the techniques that I've heard about and used with them over the years is reframing it as just energy, right? You're never tired when you're nervous because you feel this bubbling energy, and just to try to look at it as a source of energy. But what else? What are some other things that we could do in the moment if you're feeling suddenly kind of a panic or an anxiety feeling before something that you need to do?
Yeah. So before you've gone up and you're about ready to go on stage, or before they're about ready to hit that button that says we're live, is that you will have practiced learning how to go into activation, to go into excitement, to go into arousal, and bring yourself out. Just like your area of genius, as musicians, for an example, they've played these songs thousands of times. They could probably play them in their sleep. And so when it comes to regulating our body, regulating our nervous systems, is that we can be rehearsing this. And in his book, The Body Keeps a Score, he talks about these so-called involuntary mechanisms. So this is our heart rate, this is our respiratory rate, our body temperature. We can regulate that by working with the body. And so you were talking about a very important intervention, a top-down. I'm excited. I'm relabeling it. I need this energy in order to perform. It's safe. We're fine. You've got this. You've done it before. So those top-down strategies, we also want to pair with the body, because many of us have had that experience of, why do I feel completely restless and jittery and sick to my stomach, even though logically I know it's fine? So we work with the body. And one of my favorite quick hacks that I can leave us with today is vagus nerve work. And so I teach people to create a panic pack. And in that, it'll be a little bag that you can carry with you. And in that bag, you're going to have all sorts of things that are going to bring you back into your body, stimulate the brain stem. My favorite of which is a cold pack. You can get them for first aid kits. And when you get them out and shake them up, they get really cold. And then you place that on your face, around your eyes, 30 seconds, maybe on your chest, the back of your neck. We see that that activates the mammalian dive response, which will shift you out of autonomic arousal, out of fight, flight, freeze, and back into your calm and grounded self.
Wow, is that fascinating? I think the sensory things make sense. And you hear about, you know, noticing your senses, but I love that. That's very visceral. You can jump right in, put one of those in your car or your purse or whatever. That is fascinating.
Yes.
Do you think that some people are kind of empathic almost with anxiety, that they pick it up from people around them, or is it always internally sourced?
You ask the best questions. There was a research study that I was just reading last week, and they were looking at how some people have adapted to be anxious. And they looked at MRI brain scans, and they saw that some people, there was a correlation between larger amygdala size and greater amounts of empathy and anxiety. And so the amygdala is one of the parts of the brain responsible for emotional processing. And so when they have a larger amygdala, we notice that people can have bigger feelings of anxiety, bigger attunement to what's going on interoceptively in their body and in their environment. And so this superpower that makes them incredibly attuned and empathic could also be a kryptonite that they have to learn to wield. It can make them more predisposed to anxiety.
You were talking about picking up anxiety from others. We think about just our dogs, our pets that pick up on our anxiety. And we can only credit them with having the brain function that of a toddler. So it makes sense that we have that kind of empathic anxiety. Well, Dr. Nicole Kane, you have left us with some really great nuggets today. The book is called Panic Proof. It is just out. Thank you so much for joining us today. What a great conversation.
It's been an absolute joy. Thanks for having me.
And thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City.